Welcome to CSEK News, the only news source in the North truly dedicated to local stories on the ground. CSEK News addresses the diverse needs of the underserved communities between Burns Lake and Haida Gwaii through firsthand stories and in-depth interviews. CSEK News funding is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially support campus and community radio stations in Canada, as well as the Government of Canada. We are your hosts, Pam Hassan and Dan Messick, and we are on the dial at 93.9 FM, Smithers Community Radio. Our call letters are CSEK, and we are broadcasting from the unceded Gitindam territory, home of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. Follow CSEK News online at smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Smithers Community Radio.
Today on CSEK News, wildfires are raging across the province still, and it is unequivocally clear now more than ever that extreme heat, wildfires, and especially intense wildfire smoke will become familiar scenes for the next month, years, and decades to come here in Northwest BC. But how dangerous is wildfire smoke to humans? How can we determine when the air outside is too toxic or damaging to go out? These are new questions we're all grappling with just now, and if you haven't been asking yourself or others these questions yet, you should be. Just for reference, there are exactly 5 readings in air quality reporting from environmental authorities and companies. PM2.5 refers to atmospheric particulate matter, that's PM, that have a diameter of less than 2.5 micrometers, which is about 3% of the diameter of a human hair. That's very, very fine particulate matter that can get deep into your lungs. So far in the Bulkley Valley this year, we've experienced about 6 to 8 days with intense wildfire smoke just beneath or breaking the recommended threshold to be considered a danger to human health, most of which has been in this past month. But communities like Houston, Burns Lake, Vanderhoof, Prince George, and most of the central interior have been living with thick, heavy smoke for weeks on end, only recently breathing clear air thanks to the wind gods. But what does this all mean long-term, and how can we prevent or limit our exposure to wildfire smoke? Today, we'll speak with 2 experts, University of Northern British Columbia's Professor Peter Jackson from the Faculty of Environment, who will speak about an air quality monitoring interactive map he and his students have developed to better track impacts to local air quality. We'll also speak with Dr. Sarah Henderson, Scientific Director for Environmental Health Services at the BC Centre for Disease Control, regarding her research into the impacts of wildfire smoke on humans and how increased wildfire activity is opening up a new realm of research and what it means for our future living with wildfires. Stay with us.
I'm Professor Peter Jackson. I'm a professor in the Department of Geography, Earth and Environmental Sciences in the Faculty of Environment at the University of Northern BC, and I'm based in Prince George. I'm a meteorologist, and one of my areas of research is air quality, both measurement and modeling of air quality.
Great, Peter. Thanks so much for being with us today on CSEK News. Of course, as we chatted about just before we got going here, you know, smoke has been in both of our lives quite a bit recently, more so in Prince George, is watching the application, the cyclone interactive map there of what tracks the air quality, which is why I wanted to chat with you today about some of how that was developed and what it actually does, and of course how people can access it. So maybe tell me firstly about some of the research behind the air quality monitoring system and this map that you and some of your colleagues developed.
Sure. So we have a shorter URL for it now as well. It's just aqmap.ca. We'll get you to the main map quite quickly. What it is, it's a map that presents data on particulate matter from both governmental monitoring stations, so the sort of the gold standard monitors, but also a new generation of kind of citizen science type monitors that turns out to be fairly accurate. And what we do is we put both data from both monitors for PM2.5, that's particulate matter less than 2.5 microns in diameter, on the same map. We use different symbols so you can identify the high quality stations from the citizen science type stations. And then we also did some studies where we compared the low cost monitors with the gold standard monitors and developed a correction that makes the low-cost monitors more accurate, so closer to the gold standard monitors. And so our map has that on there right by default as well. And our air quality map also has some layers you can add. You can add a firework layer, which shows spatially color contours of a forecast or a model of PM2.5 levels. And you can put on the NRCan and the BC Wildfire Service wildfire locations as well. So especially useful during this time when we have so much wildfire around, and the fires generate smoke, obviously. And one of the constituents of the smoke is particulate matter. There's also other things in there as well, lots of other stuff, gases and other things. But our map and our monitors are developed to measure particulate matter.
I guess, Peter, maybe tell me a little bit about your research. Obviously, there's a lot that goes into, you know, these monitors and the measurements and making sure that they are accurate at a ground level. But, you know, what is this research showing you? How is it developed, and how is it actually translated into these, you know, the purple air monitors? It's just a little thing you just plug into the wall and attach to the outside of your home. And there's quite a lot of them. And so, you know, what is the research showing once you actually put all this data together?
Yeah, so our map displays the purple air monitors, which is one of the low-cost monitors that, as you mentioned, but also the Air Quality Egg, another brand name. Both of those monitors, Purple Air and Air Quality Egg, use the same sensor. It's made by a company in Taiwan called Plantower. So so they give the same kind of numbers, and so we're able to provide a correction that correct both of those monitors so they more closely match the gold standard monitors. So these monitors have been, sensors have been available for 10 or so years. I've been studying the advent of low-cost sensors for air quality for quite a while. And up until about 10 years ago, most of them were not very good. They're almost worthless, I would say. But there's been recent advances, and the research we've done where we compare the data from the purple air monitor, the low-cost monitor, with the governmental monitor, shows that they correlate very well. They go up and down together. There's a bit of a difference between them in terms of an error, but we can correct that error by applying an equation or a correction to the purple air monitor to make it look more like the gold standard monitor. So the purple air monitors around are purchased by a bunch of different groups, so by citizens, by ordinary people who may want to purchase one for their house, but also by various air quality agencies. So, for example, in the Bulkley Valley, I know you have an air quality agency that's put a bunch of these purple airs around. I have a collaboration with Environment and Climate Change Canada, their air quality science unit. So we put several of these monitors around Prince George, 40 or 50 of them. I've purchased a number myself through my research program. So a bunch of agencies are putting them out, as well as individuals. First Nations Health Authority has a bunch in First Nations communities, for example. And they really give us a good idea, because they do correlate so well with the gold standard monitors. We can kind of trust their numbers fairly well, and they give us a good indication of what our exposure might be when we're breathing the outdoor air in terms of particulate matter. Now, we know that particulate matter, PM2.5, is the most dangerous air pollutant. There was a World Health Organization study a few years ago that identified PM2.5 responsible for about 6 or 7 million deaths globally each year, about half of which are due to indoor air quality, so mainly people using biomass to cook inside their homes. That's mainly in the developing world. But about half of that number, about 3 or 4 million, is due to outdoor air quality. A lot of it is where levels are very high in BC and Canada and North America in general. We have relatively good air quality compared to many areas, except when we have wildfire smoke. And so that's the problem that we're facing right now.
Maybe you can walk me through the chart or the gauge, the measurements. It's color coded, and how should people interpret this if they are following the map?
Yeah, so the map has colors ranging from blues through yellows to reds, and then a kind of a dark brown at the end. And it's in PM2.5 is measured in micrograms per cubic meter, so it's the mass per volume is how it's measured. And we've tried to relate this to the Air Quality Health Index, which some of your you may be familiar with, or some of your listeners may be familiar with. The Air Quality Health Index is a health index produced by Health Canada, and it combines PM 2.5, so what we measure on the purple areas and that are on our map, but it also uses ozone and NO2. So ozone is O3 and NO2 is nitrogen dioxide. The Air Quality Health Index combines those three pollutants and comes up with a 10-point scale, 1 through 10. Some work done at the BC Center for Disease Control suggests that if you don't have ozone and NO2 available, a pretty good equivalent to the Air Quality Health Index in terms of its health impact would be to say that PM 2.5 levels from 0 to 10 are like an AQHI of 1, 10 to 20 are like an AQHI of 2, 20 to 30, like an AQHI of 3, up to 100, which is an AQHI of 10, which is the top of the scale, and then over 100 would be 10 plus. So we've used the same color scale as the Air Quality Health Index, because the information we have suggests that with PM 2.5 alone at those levels, it has an equivalent impact on health. And so we have some health messaging on there, which matches the health indexing with the Air Quality Health Index, even though what we have is not a true AQHI, because we don't monitor ozone or NO2 at those sites. Hopefully that makes sense. So the blues are generally fairly good air quality. Getting into the yellows and oranges are increasingly worse, and getting into the reds and browns are fairly bad. And depending on your health status, you may want to take particular measures to protect your health according to the levels.
I know, as you mentioned, you're not a medical health professional, but this does have an impact on human health. The amount of levels, especially when there's thick smoke, as we've seen in the last few days here in the valley, but I know there in Prince George, you've been seeing it for quite a while. What's your understanding of some of the impacts and some of the research that's helping inform some of these medical professionals about the impacts of smoke?
Sure. And there's been a lot of work on PM 2.5 in general, and a little bit of work on wildfire smoke in particular. So PM 2.5 is kind of a generic category. It includes smoke, but other dust and other kinds of things are in there as well, other products of combustion, et cetera. So we BC Environment issues an air quality advisory whenever the 24-hour average PM 2.5 level exceeds 25 micrograms per cubic meter, so at 25. And so during these wildfire smoke events, we're getting values of 100 or more, 200, 300, 400 even micrograms per cubic meter. So far in excess of the threshold for issuing an air quality advisory. So we're getting very high levels, but they're fairly acute and fairly short-lived. We know that the associations between PM 2.5 and mortality, et cetera, are more based on long-term averages. So the annual average, for example, is very important in terms of the health impacts to a population. But people also do suffer from the short-term or the acute impacts when we have very high levels for a shorter duration, perhaps. And unfortunately, some of these wildfire periods are now getting longer and longer. So instead of getting high levels for a day or two, we're experiencing high levels for a week or more, or a week several times a year, for example. And that certainly does contribute to the long-term average as well. The acute health impacts are a bit more distinct. So, you know, most of us will experience a sore throat or a dry nose or itchy eyes or a headache. We may have difficulty breathing. If that's the case, we need to take measures right away. If we have pre-existing respiratory conditions like asthma or COPD or other things like that, or heart conditions, then we need to take the levels much more seriously and be very careful about how we expose ourselves to the smoke in the outdoor environment. There are some things we can do to mitigate the risk when wildfire smoke is really high. So indoors is protective. So staying inside your house will, with the windows closed and doors closed, will cut down on the smoke. Of course, if it's really hot outside, we don't necessarily want to have the windows closed because we want to cool off our houses at night, etc. So we may want to seek refuge in an area which has filtered air, but also cooling conditions under very hot circumstances. There are indoor air filters that can be purchased with HEPA filters on them that are quite effective at removing particles from their scale according to the size of the room. and they can be particularly effective in reducing PM2.5 levels in the indoor environment. So those are some things that could be done to provide some protection against the impacts of particulate matter on health, especially if we have pre-existing health conditions, or even the very young, so infants whose lungs are still developing, or elderly people as well who may have decreased lung function or more severely impacted by this kind of smoke.
Peter, just the last thing for you. You know, obviously, this is a great resource, especially nowadays during the summer with some of these wildfires. But of course, these are around all the time, measuring, you know, especially in the spring when there's dust cleanup along the roads. There's all kinds of issues that the MP2.5, you know, comes into play. But why was this developed in the first place? Why did you want to provide this open source resource to anybody to be able to access?
Yeah, so what was missing was there were websites that showed the government monitors, the government data, which is typically one per city. So there'd be one in Smithers, for example. I think there's one in Tahlequah. There's one in Prince George, or two in Prince George, maybe. Lower Mainland has a bunch. But most places, if they're a sizable city, will have one monitor only. Very small communities won't have any monitoring. And so when we saw the low-cost monitors coming onto the scene, and we tested them and found that they were very accurate and they correlated very well. And Purple Air has its own website, which shows their monitors. We thought it would actually be helpful to pull together the Purple Air data and the air quality egg data and the government monitor data onto one website, so that a user could go in and pick a spot and look at all the monitoring that's available. The expensive monitoring that the government agencies run, as well as the low-cost monitoring that's done by ordinary people, or by people like me at UNBC who are studying air quality. And so we felt it would be useful to pull all the data together into one spot so that someone could look on a map and see what the air quality was like in their neighborhood. And I should mention, this work was really done by my graduate student, now finished, Braden Nilsson. So he was the driver behind all of this. You know, we worked together on developing the plan and identifying the issue. And he did all the work on developing the website and that kind of thing. So really, the credit for what you're seeing on the UNBC webpage goes to Braden for the hard work that he put in as part of his Master of Science thesis research.
And just one more thing, Peter, again, for our listeners, how can people access this resource?
Yeah, so we have a shortened URL. It used to be a UNBC web address, but we've got a new web address that makes it simpler to remember. So just aqmap.ca, aqmap.ca. Just put your browser there, and it'll bring up a map of kind of focused on North America. You can zoom in on your location. You can change the map background to show topography or some more plain. You can add layers to it that show smoke and active wildfires and that kind of thing. And we show all of Canada and the border states. We haven't expanded too far into the rest of North America yet for computational reasons, but we show all of Canada and the US. You can click on a station and it'll bring up a little graph that shows a time series for the last couple of weeks. And you can change the interval that's displayed so you can see how the levels have gone up and gone down over time. Yeah, so I think it's quite useful. I use it every day to look at the air quality all around BC, Prince George, Northern BC, Central BC, and to kind of monitor what's happening, especially when we have smoky days where the air quality can get really bad suddenly and then hopefully better again just as suddenly as the wind shifts.
Well, we'll stay tuned and keep an eye on the AQ map. Thanks so much for joining us and providing the insight on some of this.
Thanks very much for your interest, Dan. A pleasure talking to you.
That was Professor Peter Jackson from the University of Northern British Columbia's Faculty of Environment. Coming up next, Dr. Sarah Henderson, Scientific Director of Environmental Health Services at the BC CDC, on her research regarding the impacts of wildfire smoke on human health.
My name is Sarah Henderson. I am the Scientific Director of Environmental Health Services at the BC Centre for Disease Control. I normally work in Vancouver, but today I am at my home in Mission on the traditional territory of the Tsalo people and Little Camel First Nation.
Great, Sarah. Thanks so much for being with us today. Of course, we're here chatting about the impacts of wildfire smoke. We've been dealing with quite a bit of that here in the Bulkley Valley, never mind across the central interior, especially this year. And even down in Vancouver, we've seen some pretty thick smoke there over the last couple of months. But maybe you can tell me a little bit about, firstly, some of your research around what are some of the impacts that people can experience or expect when dealing with wildfire smoke as bad as we've seen it?
So when we're talking about wildfire smoke, when it's happening, we know that people who have existing conditions such as asthma and COPD are kind of the first to respond. And we see that smoke exposure can exacerbate those conditions. So people need to maybe go to the doctor or ER or use their rescue medications. More generally, we know that smoke makes people feel kind of gross. You know, they get some symptoms, they have maybe some runny eyes or a bit of a cough, a headache. Those are all very common symptoms. And usually we expect those sort of acute acute responses to the smoke to go away when the smoke goes away.
Maybe you can give us some sort of gauge as to where does wildfire smoke line up with other pollutants, so that the really tiny particles that seem to cause issue with a lot of these respiratory problems. So where does kind of wildfire smoke sit in that range as opposed to maybe pollutants in a bigger city? A lot of time people think we have, you know, really clean air up in the north in the country. But with wildfires, that's obviously not the case.
Yeah, that's a great question. So you're asking about fine particulate matter, or particles less than 2.5 microns in diameter. And that's one of the most important components in wildfire smoke. But we have to remember that wildfire smoke is a very complex mixture of particles and gases, and both the particles and the gases can affect how you feel. Now, when we're comparing wildfire smoke to pollution from other sources, such as traffic or industry, there's some really big differences. First of all, wildfire smoke is highly episodic. So traffic pollution, you know, cars emit about the same amount of pollution all the time in the same places. So it's pretty predictable. It varies a little bit day to day. The same thing for industry. The emissions from an industrial complex are pretty steady over time, and they're always happening in the same place. Wildfire smoke is totally different. It is highly dynamic in space and time, which I'm sure you've experienced in Smithers so far this summer. We also see that the air quality impacts, the magnitude of those impacts are much higher. So we can get very, very high PM2.5 concentrations from wildfire smoke when we never get concentrations that high from other sources. But there's a bit of a paradox here. Because we know that smoke starts to affect the health of the population pretty much as soon as it arrives, and it doesn't have to arrive in very high concentrations to affect how people feel. But people really start paying attention to the smoke when it's really, really smoky. So one of the things we kind of need to learn as a society is to start taking those precautionary measures as soon as it starts to get a little bit smoky, not only think about the health effects when those concentrations are really, really high.
Great, Sarah. That was one thing I wanted to touch upon, because we see these, you know, air quality monitors by the government. I had mentioned there's an app that we spoke to, developed at a UNBC, that tracks all of these smaller kind of personal air quality monitors. So there's a lot of them out there, and you can watch this in real time. And as we've seen with the change of wind, when we know that there's fires active, the colors go from blue to yellow, you know, to light red to dark red, and that kind of the gauge of the severity of the smoke on the PM2.5. But what I'm curious to know is, what does that actually mean? If I'm going out for 10 minutes at a dark red, you know, how am I being impacted? How are children and older folks being impacted if they go out when there's a moderate severity of smoke versus a high severity of smoke or minimal smoke?
You know, in all cases, it really depends on the individual and their individual reaction to those smoke exposures. And I know that's not a very satisfying answer, but it's true. Different people are different sensitivities to smoke. So, you know, I could go out with a good friend, I could be feeling awful, and my friend could be feeling fine. So it really, the key message here is to listen to your body. And if you're feeling okay in those smoke exposures, you're probably okay. There's still things you can do to reduce your exposure when you're outdoors. You could think about wearing a mask, you could take it easy, you know, rather than doing really heavy exercise where you're going to be breathing really hard. But generally speaking, if you're feeling okay, you're probably doing okay. And we have to remember, we do have excellent air quality in Canada most of the time. Some of these exposures that we're seeing under these smoky conditions, you know, there's people who live under these conditions every day, day in and day out around the world, because they do live in very polluted cities. So smoke is a reason for caution, but it's certainly not a reason for panic.
You know, just before we started this, we chatted about just kind of the developing or evolving rather research, because we've never really had an opportunity to study the exposures to wildfire smoke long term. So how is that changing some of your approach or methodology or just collection of data to better understand this, knowing that we are seeing bigger fires for longer periods? The wildfire season seems to be growing, and we're definitely going to see a lot more of this type of smoke this year.
Yeah, so this question about the long-term impacts of wildfire smoke exposures is very interesting and a little bit complicated. First, whenever we're talking about air pollution from any source, we always think about the acute health impacts of the air pollution and then the longer term health impacts. And usually we say, as a rule of thumb, about 20% of the health impacts attributable to air pollution are from those short term kind of day to day fluctuations. And about 80% are due to kind of your longer term, year in, year out, lifetime exposure. And when we look at how people are being exposed to air pollution in Canada in recent years, what we see is that wildfire smoke is starting to dominate people's lifetime exposures, especially in Western Canada. So because we've, you know, really effectively regulated things like vehicles and industry, they're emitting much less pollution, and over time, we're getting more and more and more exposed to wildfire smoke. There's a few things we don't know about wildfire smoke with respect to its long-term health effects. One is whether or not kind of the period of recovery that we get hopefully every year between, you know, summer and the following summer, whether or not that helps to protect us in any way from those longer term exposures. But so far in the available evidence, we do see that some indication that long-term exposure to wildfire smoke is similar to long-term exposure to other forms of air pollution. So there, you know, there is detriments to respiratory function for people who are exposed. There has been a few studies showing that the people who live in areas with more fire have more increased risk of cancer. And what we're doing now is, you know, really trying to develop the methods to study this question and to study the long-term health effects. We need to be able to follow a group of people over time, usually for at least 10 years, to examine what their exposures were over those years and then what their outcomes were. In British Columbia and in other parts of Canada, we have an excellent opportunity to do that because we have really excellent healthcare data that we can use to help us. One area of particular concern, both in Canada and internationally, is the long-term impacts on the developing fetus and on infants and young children who are exposed, because these are critical developmental periods in a human life, and because air pollution can maybe do cellular damage that would cause longer lasting effects. There are lots of people currently studying this around the world, and that's one of the big studies we have ongoing in BC right now, is looking at those infants who were in utero or born during those really severe summers of 2018 or 2017 and 2018, which now, you know, the records have been broken again in 2023 here.
Yeah, no doubt. That was, you know, one of the primary questions we had, you know, especially for young children. You know, when should people be cautioned or perhaps maybe not go outside when wildfire smoke is in the area with young children? And how young, you know, would you say? You talk about infancy and kind of when people are born, but what about toddlers or younger children?
Yeah, so there's a few challenges here. There's, again, the evidence is sort of limited, but I would encourage anybody who's pregnant to take precautions to reduce their smoke exposures during pregnancy. We have enough evidence to suggest that these exposures are associated with negative birth outcomes, such as preterm birth, and potentially lower respiratory health among those infants in their early life. Now, I'd want to be especially careful around newborn infants whose lungs are just kind of encountering air for the first time, and really try to protect them from those smoke exposures. And then, you know, when we're talking about toddlers and younger children, obviously, if those children have conditions such as asthma, we want to take precautions. And we're going to keep a really close eye on them. So one of the reasons children are at higher risk is because, first of all, they breathe faster than adults, and they breathe more air per kilogram body weight than adults do because they're growing and they need that oxygen to develop. Second of all, when they're outdoors, they tend to be more active than adults are. So they like to run around and play. Obviously, these are great things for children to do. But on those smoky days, it can lead to higher exposure. So once again, it's precaution is what I'd recommend, not panic. But, you know, just the more you work to reduce the exposures in children and adults, the better their health is going to be protected.
Sarah, just the last thing for you. Of course, all of this is incredibly useful information for a lot of the people that we tend to hear in the Bulkley Valley and the northwest of BC right now that are experiencing some of these wildfires. But what can people do to limit their exposure from wildfire smoke?
Yeah, so the key number one piece is take a look at the indoor air in your home, because most of us spend the vast majority of our time inside. We really want to be working to keep that air as smoke-free as possible. So, you know, we'll often say we'll close the windows and doors, and that makes sense to do, especially, but only if you're not going to end up overheating in your home, because it's also dangerous to be too hot. But even with doors and windows closed, we know that smoke can still get inside. It's pretty tricky that way. You know, it can come in through any vents or any other gaps or openings in the building envelope. So we highly recommend that people use portable air cleaners to clean that smoke out of the indoor air. And what we've found in recent years is that commercial air cleaners are very effective, but so are these, you know, less more affordable alternatives made with a box fan and some furnace filters. Those can also be really great at getting those small particles out of the air. If you can't clean the air in your entire home, then focus on one room where you spend a lot of time, your bedrooms, children's bedrooms, those sorts of places, so that people are protected while they're sleeping and maybe at other times during the day. That's number one, focus on the indoor air. Number two, when you are outside, there are some precautions that you can take. So first of all, if you're wearing a well-fitted respirator, such as an N95 or KN95, We've all got these kicking around still from the pandemic, or most of us do. That can really help to cut the particles that you're breathing, as long as it is well fitted. Air's got to go through the mask and not around the mask. And then, as I said earlier, simply taking it easy can go a long way. So, you know, when you're at rest, as an adult, you might be breathing about 6 liters of air per minute. If you are out for a run, you're breathing more like 60 liters of air per minute. So taking it easy and really kind of not overexerting yourself and not breathing too hard will limit how much smoke you inhale and how deep it gets into your lungs as well. So those are kind of the primary precautions people can take.
All right. Great, Sarah. Thanks so much for your insight and thoughts today. We very much appreciate it. And we'll be sure to stay in touch if anything comes up in the future.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Take care.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.